Welcome, everybody. We haven't got Hannah tonight. Danny's sort of standing in for Hannah slash being a guest tonight. Welcome, everybody, to tonight's Family Law Live. Can everyone please mute their microphones if they haven't already? I'm not sure if Danny's got the power to do that regardless, but anyway, if you can mute. And also, if you've got any questions, can you send them to Hero, please? And we'll address those at the end. And cheers to anyone who isn't doing dry January and is having a little tipple to try and get them through this very long month. So tonight we're lucky enough to be joined by a stellar panel, as always, which includes the founder of Raiden Solicitors, which has seven offices in and around North London, and the founder of Glynis Wright & Co, based in Leicester. So welcome, Katie and Glynis.
Hello.
Hi. Where's, I can't see Kate. Oh yeah, there you are. Sorry, I'm just trying to find the relevant square on my screen. So I think it would be interesting for our audience to hear about your individual stories of where you've come from, the family law world, to where you are now. So Glynis, can I start with you, please?
Yeah, most certainly. Hello, everybody. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, great stuff. Okay, so those of you who don't know me, my name is Glynis Wright, and I came into the law actually at a slightly later age of 40. And very quickly, after having been made a partner in one of our local Leicester firms when I was 3 years qualified, stayed with them for a couple of years and then decided that I wanted to set up my own law firm. And so I set up a law firm which focused entirely on family law and mediation issues called Glynis Wright & Co, Family Solicitors and Mediators. And the idea actually was to be a sole practitioner. I just wanted to hang on to my own profit, effectively. But probably by the end of the first 6 months, as I was deluged with work, it became quite apparent that I wasn't going to stay a sole practitioner. So I incorporated at the end of my first year and then started growing a specialist team of family lawyers. Sorry, I can hear a lot of noise.
So yeah, no,
it's not
a lot of
time. Are you able to mute, Danny?
I think it's Courtney, put yourself on mute, darling. Great. Okay. So I started building up my team of specialist family lawyers and also started building the brand, much more importantly, of Glynis Wright & Co. And a lot of you won't be from the Leicestershire region, and therefore you may not know of Glynis Wright & Co, but in the East Midlands, we built up a very well-known presence. And we successfully managed that for the best part of 10 or 11 years, growing to a £1.2 million firm. And last December, not the December just gone, forgive me, but the previous December, I made the decision to sell my shares in the law firm. I stayed the sole shareholder and I sold to an East Midlands firm you've probably heard of called Nelson's, who are sort of broadly speaking £18 million company, who were very interested in acquiring Glynis Wright & Co in order to continue to deliver family law services for Leicester. So I've always said that I've done the whole kind of range, really. You know, I came in late to law. I know what it's like to be a trainee solicitor, and within no time, 3 years or so of qualifying, I was a partner in a legal firm. 2 years after that, I was running my own firm as director. And now I've gone full circle and I'm equity partner in Nelson's. So that's quite a significant journey, but a huge part of that journey and the success of that journey has, of course, been marketing, which is what we're all here to talk about. Oh, and perhaps I should mention, on the very day I sold my shares to Nelson for value, I hasten to add, which was the 4th of December 2020, I also received then an email from the Cabinet Office telling me that I'd been awarded an MBE, and it was a complete surprise for those cynics out there. I did not know, and that was for female leadership. Which was wonderful to actually find you've got an MBE for being a businesswoman on the day that you sell your shares and actually sort your retirement fund out. So that was absolutely amazing. I didn't believe it. I had to phone up to find out if it was true or not, and it was, but what a great day that was. So that's me, and I'm delighted to be here, looking forward to the questions.
Fabulous. Katie, can we hear from you now, please?
So I started off at Sears Tooth. At the time, there was a Sears and a Tooth together. It was their second incarnation. I am far too young to know, but there used to be something called a Telex machine, and Sears Tooth's I don't know what you'd call it, name on the telex machine, was Tooth and Nail. So it already, by the time I joined Sears Tooth, there was a, they had a reputation, they'd fight you tooth and nail, la 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 la. And Raymond met a lot of his clients on the race course because he owned lots of horses, or through the newspaper because he was in the Daily Mail. Still is, obviously. And then I went to Farrers, and I was at Farrers for 9 years. And I was there when the Baroness Shackleton was there, and then she moved to Payne Hicks Beach, and I stayed with Richard Powery and his team. And so by the time I left Farrers, I was 35, and Farrers have their client template, as we all have. And I was thinking about, well, how am I going to build up my casework? And it was difficult at Farrers to have the same sort of casework. I don't have someone knocking on my door saying, I've seen you on the telly. I don't invite authors for dinner. I don't sit next to Earl Watson. And so when I set up my firm, the aim was, and I was very clear, that I was going to act for people who couldn't quite afford Farrers. So I acted for the chauffeur of one of Farrers' clients, the younger brother, the teacher, and that's how I started. So the aim was to be cost effective, but the partners referring work to me would have the comfort that I'd been properly trained and I was be giving them good advice. But I started the firm when my youngest baby was a baby. And so I had a very slow growth pattern. And so he's now 17, the firm is now 17, and we're much bigger. But really, when I started, I was only working 2 half-days a week, then 2 days a week, then 3 days a week. And then as I got busier, I was working 5 days a week, and then took someone on, we could both work part-time again. So it took me 6 or 7 years before I hired a full-time person. But now we've got 7 offices, we're the 4th largest family team in the country. And what we aim for is that every client that comes to us has the assurance that they're going to get expert legal advice and we can help sort out their problems. So part of the marketing strategy for us is for every client, for us not to have a dud. You know, we don't have a dud office. We don't have an embarrassing solicitor that, you know, we don't give any work to. What we aim for is to have a consistency in terms of quality, but obviously have lots of different approaches. So that's where we are.
So just before we move on to the next question, would you both just quickly say that the key to it is having that vision in the beginning to what you want to achieve? Because I think you both said, Katie, that you wanted to be sort of Farrers' plan B, and then Glynis, you also wanted to be a certain presence in Leicester. So did you feel like that was the key, having that clarity on what you wanted the firm to be?
No. I'm glad that you're shaking your head.
Not at all.
No, because as Glynis was saying, she was going to start off on herself. I was going to start off myself. I had no idea what I'd be like this in 17 years. I had belief in myself. I had belief in my ability. And I had a very firm vision of what I wanted to give to a client. But after that, I had no idea.
What I'd add to that, and that is exactly my sentiment as well. I just wanted to keep my own money. That was why I set up on my own. But it was quite clear very early on with the amount of work that started coming in. And I, fortunately, my son was closer to 14 or 15 when I did it. So I could actually throw myself in full throttle. And it became clear that I would need to develop my team and start pushing out there, and that I had the capabilities to do it. So I think the passion to become that specialist presence in your city and then hopefully your area actually grows with your own experience. And each time you realize I can do this and you achieve something, whether it's your first award, whether it's your first brilliant appointment, whether it's your first leadership role in the community, you build up that confidence in yourself to take your vision forward, and the vision grows with you, I would say.
Good answer. So self-belief and passion then, that's what we need. to set up our own firms. So just moving on to sort of the next point. So I just wondered if you can both tell us a bit about your approach to marketing, because obviously that's what we're here to discuss. So I don't know if Glynis, you might want to go first.
Okay, sure, no problem. What I would say to anybody who's thinking about marketing, and I appreciate, you know, a corporate firm may take a very, very different approach to a boutique specialist family law service such as my own. But 360 degree marketing, a lot of the mistake that, and I think particularly corporates can make, is to actually look at something that's been successful, whether that's a magazine or whatever, and to keep on doing the same thing. My own view is you have to never sit on your laurels with marketing. 360 degree means you think about the magazines that are successful. You think about getting your lawyers trained up to go out on radio. You think about your CSR and you engage in special projects in community. You take on leadership roles. You ensure that your team understand how important each of them individually are within your community, and when they go out there, they don't just sit on a table of other lawyers, they sit on the table of business people, and they talk to the business people because those are our clients. You make sure that your social media is intact, you have a presence which is ever ready in social media, and actually you get your brand known by not necessarily always talking about the thing that you do. You allow people to judge your personality and the personality of your lawyers. You become very much a community and a team presence. It takes hard work. And what I never found successful was simply paying a marketing agency or a PR agency to do the work for me. I always felt it was far better if I had my own strategies, and those strategies were constantly organic and constantly moving on with my own community. So I very, very rarely would go back and do the same thing again. I'd always look at a new way of raising our profile and getting the brand out there. And as you know, Fiona, the one thing that was very successful, and some lawyers frown upon it, was the billboards. When I just met somebody.
I was trying to ask about that.
Well, it was great. I've always wanted to be famous. You know, if I took a 90 sheeter, I could have had a 40 sheeter. I thought, no, if I'm going to go up there, I might as well go up there big. And actually, I had a great photographer and I had a great person to work for. And I did a lot of research into where those billboards should be placed. I didn't expect them to go viral as they did. But the very first one that went up went viral. And after that, I put my team up there and there was a particular image that went with it and it worked. And that image was all about, we're here, this is what we look like, this is who we are, we're here serving you in your community now. That's the phone number, pick it up now. And it made us so approachable and it made us so known and familiar within our community. And with everything else that we were doing, with thought leadership and with sponsorship opportunities and a lot of CSR, it meant that our brand built very, very quickly. So never rest on your laurels is what I would advise.
Brilliant. And Katie?
I think when you're listening to Glynis, and she is a complete force of nature, all those ideas are the strategy that everybody does. I don't do billboards on my face. I've got penguins all over, but it's the same thing. And it's the same for all the other firms out there. You've got to decide what you want to be known for. If you're a multidisciplinary firm, you want to be known as the one-stop shop. You come to us and we can solve all your problems. If you're going to be a niche, you're going to be the family law experts. If you're going to be somebody who really, really likes rugby, you're going to be that really nice bloke or woman who can sort out your problems on the rugby pitch or on the school run. Or everything Glynis has said should apply to all 130 people. You know, you might find talking to people excruciatingly embarrassing, but write an article, write to Family Law Journal, become the expert on Brussels too, and where it's come after Brexit, or, you know, which I think is really impressive if you can write an article about that. But, you know, there's loads of different things. And what I've learned is, as Glynis has said, the strategy isn't one size fits all. And you can't say, and that's what I wanted, that's what I learned leaving Sears Tooth and Flowers. I couldn't try to be the next Raymond or the next Fiona. I just had to be the next me. And that's what my team have to do. They have to be the next them, and they have to write an article or do resolution wires or Beaconsfield Young Professionals or whatever it is. Because you've got to do, And the aim is not to sell divorce, but just to become a trusted advisor, which is a word that's used all the time. But that's what it is. We're just saying, talk to us and trust us about any problems.
Yeah, because I think people think, well, how do I sort of advertise divorce? When actually what we're saying is we're offering solutions, we're trusted advisors. That's what we're saying. We're not sort of touting for divorce as the media would have it.
No. And I think there's a real snooty atmosphere about that. You know, oh, it's divorce day. You know, we don't advertise for your divorce. But if you're saying you don't advertise for divorce, then your marketing strategy is that we're by appointment only and we're exclusive. That is a marketing strategy. It means you've got one. It just means you're not doing a billboard. You're just saying we're on closed doors and you have to have a client reference to come to us. Don't kid yourself. Everybody has a marketing strategy, whether it's an advert or it's word of mouth or somebody at your club. It's the same thing.
And the other thing I think that you mentioned before was the importance of tracking data.
Well, yes, that comes down to what Glynis was saying. You know, obviously you're not going to get an instant answer all the time, but you've got to know what you're spending your money on and where your clients are coming from. If all your clients are coming from a barrister based in Bath, and you've never instructed them, and you've never taken them out for lunch, then you need to know that. If they're coming from a little advert in Mark Yate Matters, that's, you know, a half page advert for 75 quid, then that's worth knowing. And then equally, you can spend thousands of pounds on an advert in the Sunday Times supplement, but you only know what to spend your money on if you've tracked the data.
Absolutely.
Well, not the money, what to spend your efforts on.
Yeah. Absolutely. And if I could just come in on that point, in my experience, the thing that a lot of law firms spend most of their money on is usually the least productive. The most productive is garnishing the energy of your lawyers and yourself to get out there into the community and be known. Because if you're known, they know, everybody knows each other's occupation within 30 seconds of meeting. Oh, what do? Handshake. So you say what you are. You don't need to say anything else. If they get to know you and you build a relationship with them, they'll remember you when somebody close to them is going through a divorce. You don't have to oversell yourself anyway, and none of your lawyers should. And the other thing I would say is, and I gave a speech to a bunch of Leicester University students recently, they were really shocked to hear that I would be asking about what they can contribute to business development in an interview. And it's one of my key questions, because coming out of the academic world, they weren't really kind of honed for that. But every single lawyer should be doing a percentage of BDO. And as Catherine quite rightly said, not everybody's great at going up on a stage, and not everybody's great at going up on a billboard or would want to, or going on the radio. So find out what they are good at, get them to elect what they're good at, and get pledges from them about what they're going to do each week to assist you.
Well, I think you can do it at any level as well. I mean, obviously, if you're a paralegal, you can write an article, or you can just come to an event and get yourself used to getting out there and meeting people. So it's never, ever off limits at any level. So, yeah, I think you're right. If you go into an interview, you need to be prepared to say, what have you thought about in terms of business development? For sure.
Absolutely.
So touching on what we've just been saying, so obviously referrals are usually your key work source, either from other solicitors or from clients. So just would you mind both sort of talking about how that works and how important that is to your business? I'd imagine very important, actually. So yeah. I don't know whether Glynis, you want to
start? Sure. No worries at all. So obviously referrals should be the biggest area of expansion in your firm. If you don't get referrals, you're doing something wrong. No amount of marketing is going to get you over the hurdle if you don't have a good reputation, because all that happens is you look like a great Christmas present wrapped up in tinsel, and everybody thinks, wow, they buy the product, open it up, and it's empty inside. And you're never, ever going to grow as a firm or maintain a reputation on that basis. So obviously in any firm, recommendations and referrals should be 90% of what you have coming in. But with Catherine and I, at some point in our beleaguered, intense lives, we decided that we were going to really push it out there and grow our firms. I'm so impressed with what Catherine's done. I mean, 7 offices is phenomenal. I certainly never achieved that. But in order to do that, you have to market. It's not all going to come in on recommendations at the speed you would want it to. So you just basically do the marketing so that you can expand your team of lawyers and expand your brand. But the core of what you do should always be that every single client you turn into a green shoe, every single client has to be sending somebody else to you. And that is fundamental, absolutely fundamental.
Yeah. And do you use Trustpilot, Glynis, or did you ever use that?
Google, no, but Google reviews, most certainly, they're really, really important. I mean, unfortunately, of course, the Glynis Wright & Co. website, I think, only been taken down in about the last 6 months. But we had huge numbers of reviews. And it was, again, something you get all of your lawyers to do. If they're telling you, I'm so proud I did this amazing case, great, get them to give you, whether it's Trustpilot, whether it's Google, whatever the review is, get that client to give you a review. If they're happy, they'll do it. And you build up, because nowadays people do look at reviews and there's no getting around it. They will look at
it. You can also use it as testimonials for directories and things like that. So they can always be repurposed and put on your profile. That's what I've done.
Yes, they're hugely powerful. If you build up a body of really fantastic 5-star reviews, they're incredibly powerful. And they can turn a client who might be, you know, shopping around at 2 or 3 firms, it can turn them towards you. And they can tell if they're legitimate. They can tell from the narrative if that is an honest review, because the way that somebody talks about a divorce and what they went through is very, very personal. And that also helps because it comes across to the person who's about to go on that journey.
And try and make sure they're organic, everybody, because that's what people are quite alive to. Because if you plant them, as in you invite them, it does actually say that on Trustpilot. I don't know if people are aware of that, but it says whether it's organic or whether they've been invited. And if you're savvy, you will know that that person has been not planted, but has been sort of placed there. So that's just something to note if anybody didn't know that. So yes, Katie, over to you in terms of referrals.
When I first spoken to marketing experts, their general view is that multidisciplinary firms aren't very good at cross referrals. One niche firms like mine, we know we're not going to get any cross referrals within the firm, really. But if you're in a multidisciplinary firm, you should that's your first source of referral. It's a source of referral that us family, or someone like me, I can't hope to emulate. And so, but yet I think that's a surprising source that doesn't get used very much. You'll get your mate Sarah, who was a trainee with you, and she's now the partner in the property firm, and she'll send work to you. But then if you leave, she'll send it to you in your new firm. She won't send it to your replacement, Bob, who's, and I think that's a really important work of a source of referrals that I don't need to deal with. But referrals, as Glynn says, she said 90%. We're down to about 60, probably 60% of our work is from referrals now, because we've got a bit more of a brand presence. But the thing about referrals is that they tend to be really good quality. It tends to be a client who knows they have to pay for the legal services, probably understands the team structure, knows that they need a lawyer rather than Wicco divorce or something like that. And once you've done a good job, they then, the partners used to say to me, from Farrah's and things, if I send you some work and you do a good job, I look good. So they'll say, oh, that Fiona was really lovely. She said she couldn't act for me because I was only worth £2 million and she was dealing with, Princess What's It. But what a nice lady. So what that means is that when that person has a £60 million case, it will go to Fiona. And then her mate, who's only got £2 million, will come back. So actually, the referral source gains from referring work to me. Puts pressure, and equally puts pressure on you, because you mustn't muck it up, because it then reflects badly. But I think referrals are key.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about relationship building, and sort of on that, I'm going to bring Danny in, king of building relationships. with solicitors. So I just wondered if you wanted to talk about that end of your role, Danny.
So our marketing's obviously very different to what Katie's and Glynis's is, in the sense that, you know, our marketing is aimed at solicitors. And the one thing I think is incredibly important for any solicitor is to have a good relationship with the chambers that you instruct or the barristers that you instruct. And the main reason for that is that we are effectively an extension of your services. So, for instance, if Fiona instructs, rings up and says, I've never used this person before, one of the clerks has recommended them, what do you think? That's not me to get it right, because the thing is, clients don't, as I say, they don't differentiate really between chambers and the solicitors, because you're the one who goes back to them and says, look, I work with this chambers an awful lot. You can rely on them. If they say this person's good, they're going to be really good. Like Katie said earlier on, if that person then gets it wrong, they're not going to think, I'll never, the client, I mean, they're never going to think, well, I'm never going to instruct 36 again. They'll come back to you and effectively blame you for making the wrong recommendation. Now, obviously, not everything works out the way it should be. I wish it did, but it doesn't. But and it could be a host of reasons. It could be an unreasonable client. It could be just a poor judgment. That's kind of understandable. But if it's just a complete horror show and just nothing happens the way it should do, then that looks bad on you to the client. You then think, well, I'm never going to trust you again, 36, because you've let me down. But also, if you get it right, then the relationship is, you know, it's going to fly. And as we mentioned earlier on, if you make a referral to us and we do a great job, client doesn't think we're great. They just automatically think you're fantastic. And then you're going to trust me again with new work or with new recommendations. So it is absolutely key to have a good relationship with either the chambers you instruct or certainly the barristers that you instruct.
So is a lot of your role basically about that relationship building and...
Yeah, and building trust. And building trust, because, as I say, with Glynis and Katie, it's their business. It's as personal as it can get to them, and it's their name above the door. So, you know, it's bad to get it wrong, full stop. But if you get it wrong and their name's over the door, I don't think they're going to be sending me too many Christmas presents. It is absolutely key. And again, if you get it right, you'll be trusted again. Everyone can get something wrong, but it's that trust element. You know, it's what I always say is we're never just going to keep something in the diary because it's an extra couple of grand. You know, we would rather... If the barrister isn't right for the case, and that's not to say that the barrister isn't good, it's just if they're not right for the client and the case, then we'd rather pass it up, because we want, you know, we want to build the relationship, and that's where we stand. And I think Katie said it before about not having a dud in the team, because if you've got a dud in the team and you refer the work to them and they mess it up, that's a whole line of potential referrals up the Swanee. So you are better off making sure you get, if it's your own firm, the right lawyer looking after the case, as Glynis and Katie both do. And I completely recommend you do it with a barrister as well, because, as I say, in the client's eyes, they're not going to look at chambers, they're going to look at you. And it's, you know, we are effectively an extension of your business.
I think that's right. I mean, I think you absolutely have to play the long game in a lot of these things. In a lot of the relationships you build, you might meet somebody, you know, and then you don't hear from them for a couple of years. I mean, I used to row many years ago, well, maybe like 10 years ago. And this week I've had two inquiries from this, like from people from my rowing club. So that just shows you, like 10 years later, you know, when they're all getting divorced, unfortunately. It was really random, but it's stuff like that where you think, well, you know what, if you nurture relationships as a rule, then things, you know, can come out of the woodwork. Anyway, I shall move on to my next question. So we all know that social media is a key to brand building in this day and age. So I just wanted to ask both of you how you approach that. And again, if I can start with Glynis.
Okay, well, when I was a smaller team than I ended up being at the point I sold to Nelson's, I did all of my own social media until I felt that my team themselves were ready to understand the brand and the message that had to be carried out from Glynis Wright & Co. to make sure it was consistent. And I really enjoyed that. But again, I decided that it had to be right across the board. So LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, etc. And you have to be able to keep the momentum going on it, which means that you should be doing 2-3 posts a week minimum. And I think I also realise that people actually want to hear about you. They don't just want to hear that no-fault divorces are coming in and this is what we say about it and this is what we say about that. It's a revolution in blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I mean, that's very, very useful. They actually want to know who you are and they want to know what your values are. So actually make sure in your social media that you're conveying that to people, because actually your ethics is very important to your client. And particularly so as a divorce lawyer, I'm sure Catherine will agree, part of the reason why we don't sell divorce and we're actually just saying we'll give you a really good, trusted, supportive service is because people need to know that you're not going to be shaking out their pockets and making it worse for them. So conveying that message is very important. But I did also then, when we got bigger and I just had too much to do, I tried to get an individual member of my team to do the social media. That didn't work. I tried to allocate it to, right, that solicitor this week, that solicitor next week. That didn't work. What did work was a combination of using an agency, because I then put it out to an agency. Although that agency, who I've worked with ever so well, and they're fantastic, they would admit that I was quite controlling about that. I'll be really honest. There was never going to be a social media post that went out that I hadn't checked and usually rewritten, which made me wonder why I wasn't just doing it myself anyway. But they came up with some really good ideas, and it was great to get some creative spirit outside of my own brain. And that, combined with the lawyers doing their own bits as and when they went out, meant that we actually got really, really good coverage. But as I say, it has to be a combination of some thought leadership, some who you are, some about your values, some on brand. You've got to keep it interesting. And at the moment, obviously, Nelson's and I are working together very successfully on how we merge our brands, which I'll say something about later. Yeah. And that's very interesting, because their approach and what their digital manager does is very different from the sorts of things that I've been doing. So we've had some really interesting debates about that, which I'll perhaps talk about later.
Yeah, I am going to come back and ask you about that. So Katie?
I was just going to say that social media is just the new type of thing. So in olden days, you would know what sort of person would pick up a Good Housekeeping magazine versus Loaded or Closer or Now. And what social media does, it just helps you tweak that. And so we use Facebook to promote some blogs and some posts, and we use Instagram for more visual things. Instagram tends to be used as parental support, so half-term guides, what's going on in Hertfordshire, pumpkin, you know, where the nearest pumpkin farm is and all of that. And then we'll also say what to do if this is your first Christmas on your own, and then we'll slip in what to do if there's a dispute between Christmas. So what we're trying to do is provide some free content which shows what our values were, as Glynis was saying. That's Instagram. I'm a complete fan of Twitter. I was the first person in my firm today to find out about the new edict from Mostyn and everyone about the new family forms, the new schedule of assets, the new rules in family procedure rules, because somebody put it on Twitter. I think Twitter is a really good resource for lawyers. I don't use it much to talk about my own values because I'm a bit of a voyeur on Twitter, but it's important to understand what social media is. For Facebook, you've got all the different groups. So I'm part of the St. Albans Mums group. We've got some people in RT that are part of the Hampstead Mums group. There's a single mothers group that I used to be on, but I got kicked off because I'm not a single mother. I went on it because I was helping my sister out. And what social media does is it groups people together in a way you don't know about. You know that people who buy fishing magazines are all fish people, but now if you have a Facebook page, you've got the link, and so it's a really it's a really good way to try and direct your marketing. But as Glynn said, you have to do it in a way that provides free content without saying, come to us, we're the best. It has to be things like that.
What I've found is that you really need to find your voice on it if you're going to do it consistent. Because you can try and sound super intellectual and or whatever, but if you don't sound like yourself and you don't sound authentic, then it's just not going to work. The most successful sort of Instagram feeds, and mine is definitely not one of them, is sort of, you know, like Laura Nasa from Pennington. I mean, she has got it completely nailed. She has it, the whole look of it is just really professionally done, but it's authentically her, and it is about her, as well as the law. So she does that very well. And I think that's the thing, is to find your own voice. Consistency and authenticity, I think, are really, really key. But really, really hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, when you say authentic, I can tell you a lot. You know, I've had a rubbish letter today from a rubbish firm talking about completely misunderstood something. If I was truly authentic, I'd put something on Twitter about it, and I don't. I don't ever say, I had a great day in court, I had a bad day in court, so pleased I, you know, got the kids to see their dad. So the authenticity is really important, and I completely agree with Glynn, is you have to show what you're like, but I'm really careful not to talk about anything I do with my work at all, because I just worry.
It's important, obviously, confidentiality is important, but I also think boundaries are important for mental health, because you need to know where that line is, and I think it takes a skill to know where that line is. I don't talk about myself, but I know that when I first started Instagram and I'd put pictures of myself out and about, that would get way more likes than just writing something about law.
Yeah.
You know, if I went to meet somebody for breakfast, or, you know, that was a picture of me, got much more interest, just because people are inherently interested in people, aren't they?
Exactly right. And sorry, that is such a careful balance, because in family matters particularly, you can have very easily somebody coming onto your social media with a bit of a grudge, because of course, no matter how ethical we are, there's always somebody that might feel that they had a hard time because we were representing their ex-husband or their ex-wife, and they were perhaps a litigant in person. And it doesn't matter that you acted with absolute integrity, they might not see it that way. And you have to really be very careful, because of course that can be an invitation as well. But that's probably the case across the board nowadays, that we're all aware that social media is a fantastic resource that we should be tapping into. But there is a downside to that as well, which is that you're more exposed. You can have 50 fantastic five-star reviews. Somebody, just out of spite, even if they've never even heard of your firm, will spot that and go on and give you a one-star review just because they don't want you to have an impeccable record. And that can
I've been trolled on Twitter and LinkedIn, which I honestly saw as a mark of my success on social media, because I couldn't believe I'd been trolled. I was like, wow, I must be doing something right that somebody could even be bothered to comment on this. And it was about, I think it was, one was about no fault divorce, and I think I can't even remember what the other one was, but I mean, you wouldn't even think that you could be trolled about something like that, because we're actually doing something good for society. But there you have it. So my next question is about sort of directories, and obviously people can get themselves really stressed about this. Are they going to get a mention? Are they not? And things like that. I mean, do you actually think that that's important, or is it really peer to peer? You know, is that really about peer to peer exposure?
You go first, Catherine. I'll come
if
in after.
If all 130 of us could agree today that we're not going to do it, and we're not going to make any submissions,
I'm signing up.
Then that's fine, and I won't do it. But there are reality, and I think, you know, we're tier one in St Albans, which I'm sure people will say is not nowhere near as good as tier one in Birmingham or London. Well, I can't be in London because I don't have an office there. So I think you just have to be a little chilled about it. It's really nice when somebody says something nice about you. We got our feedback on Chambers last week. We looked, and one of the comments for us was, I don't really know the firm, so I can't comment. Brilliant. And then another comment was, a I really do think a family firm, I really do think a firm should offer more than just family law, and they should do residential conveyancing. So, you know, they're sort of, I don't think, but generally, I think they're here to stay, and I think you just got to, but you've got to be chilled about it, because if that, you know, you've got trolling, I've got people saying they want to give me a reference by saying they don't know who I am. It's,
yeah. How about you, Glynis?
When you first started asking the question, I thought you were talking about directories like Legal 500, actually. I didn't know.
You are.
Okay, I'll answer that question then. So in all of my time of running Glynis Wright & Co, goodness knows how many thousands of clients we worked with in the end, I personally was only ever asked if we were in the Legal 500 by one client. So that showed me, I never really worried about it when I was at Glynis Wright & Co. That showed me that it wasn't something that my firm had to do in order to get business in. And it was actually not a great priority for my clients. Since we went to Nelson's, I'm now in the Legal 500. And I do think it's something that is very important to corporate firms. I think it's perhaps more important to corporates. And it may well be because with that, you know, what Catherine was talking about earlier with cross-department referrals, you're perhaps more likely to get corporate clients coming across for their divorces, and it might be the kind of question that perhaps they're asking. So I can see it's certainly not a bad thing to have. At the time, I was just too busy, to be perfectly frank, and we had so much work pouring in. I was busy expanding the team and so on, to be writing forms or asking people to fill out forms, whatever you do. But it's no bad thing. But I personally do not think it is the number one priority for the majority of family clients. Reputation and ethics are the two key ingredients for any client going through divorce or a child dispute, in my view.
Yeah, I have to say, I think it is really about a peer, impressing your peers more than getting clients, really. It's nice to put on your email address, but
yeah.
Anyway, so sort of coming to the end of the questions, but what would you say has affected your practices regarding COVID, if anything? Have you seen any change in the way people are approaching law firms because of COVID? Glynis?
Well, I think every single family lawyer who's on this seminar have probably worked their socks off in the last, you know, 18 months, 2 years. So in terms of practice, what's happened is we've all had tons more work coming in. That will probably change. We don't know for sure, but how can there be so many accelerated divorces with that not impacting 2 or 3 years down the line? What I have certainly found is that it's been an even more intense time, as in our clients are always going to be stressed, but they're even more stressed because their economic foundations in some cases have been ripped away from them, their businesses are gone to the wall and so on. And so the domestic violence that goes with that has led to all sorts of more significant pressures within the family dynamic than ever. So in terms of the way we market, we have to acknowledge that, and we have to even more reassure the members of the public that we're aware of what they're going through and that we can provide a service in this difficult time. And I think the needs of the client have accelerated as a consequence of COVID, and probably will do for some considerable time. But it's also an opportunity, because never have people seen more how they need to have lawyers to be able to support them through such difficult times. So it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to expand at the moment, but bear in mind that it probably won't last. And just get with the curve on it and make sure that you are topical and you are making sure that people understand you've thought about these issues and you're responding to them.
Katie?
Pre-COVID, our local county, when we went to our local court users group, one of the judges said, oh yeah, you're the firm who does all that arbitration, and we're based in, you know, and he was talking about our St. Albans and Berkhamsted office, and he made it sound that we felt we were too posh to go to court. And the feedback we got was that the courts were fed up of us taking away the good cases with lots of money and doing it ourselves and leaving the shitty, with the, you know, counsel, the smaller value cases. Now COVID's come along and there's been pressure on the court system, and your trial is pulled because somebody's got COVID. Suddenly, I would say the biggest change of our practice is now ADR seems to be relevant to all the firms were saying, can we try arbitration? Now they're far more willing to listen to it. And it's, and I think part of it is when people were first selling arbitration, they say, oh, it's confidential, your client got to appear in the papers. Well, you know, that doesn't happen. That's not relevant for most of my clients. So I think the ADR has had a really welcome, has been far, the other firms around us have been far more welcoming to ADR, and they have listened to it more because they can now see that it's worth spending time. The other thing was, pre-COVID, I was known as being a really flexible employer, and we had loads of part-time staff. I realised that wasn't actually true because my fee earners used to work from home, but actually my business support staff didn't. So since COVID, all of our staff work from home. My receptionist works from home, my secretaries work from home, my finance team, my marketing people. And I think that will continue. We'll probably do 2 or 3 days a week. 40 or 60% of our work will be in the office. I'm not sure I'm going to pop to council's chambers anymore for cons. I'll do it pre a hearing, if we have a hearing in person. But I think Danny and I are going to be destined to be talking to each other via Zoom for most of the time, which is a shame. But, you know, why should I spend an hour and a half of my time on the train to go to a 2-hour con when I can just log in? Those are the big differences. I think it's been really interesting to see what happens to New London lot, because I know that the London firms are talking about being really flexible, but the London offices are really, really expensive and they're really beautiful, and they are only going to work if there's bums on seats. But yeah, I have a sneaky suspicion that if Goldman Sachs and White and Cave and all the American firms can say, we want you in, I think the London firms might do that more. But I'm just cynical, because I think everyone should come and work in my firm rather than work in London. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's really interesting. I'm really pleased to see that the courts have come a bit more on board with digital systems. I was tearing my hair out when some courts would only do Zoom, some would only do CBP, some would only do telephones. We've got one judge in one of our local courts insists on a paper bundle being delivered, even though the court is shut and you can't get paper bundles through, you know. But generally, I think it's been quite innovative for everybody.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to just return to that question that we talked about before about merging boutique firms with sort of commercial firms.
Yes,
we wanted to talk about the marketing challenges of how you merge the brands.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, if there's any big firms here who like to acquire, then it will be particularly interesting to them, I think, because if you're going to acquire a small firm, then there must be a reason why you want to do it. And that must be that small firm has been highly successful. Effectively, I always saw small firms as being like the little piranhas. You know, we nip around biting at the business, and the big firms are like the big sharks swimming around. But there must be something they've got really right. So you buy them. So don't squash the brand. I'm very pleased to say I don't think Nelson's have done that at all. And they've pretty much embraced the way that Glynis Wright and co have done things. And so I've had lots of meetings with the marketing team who are excellent. And we've been merging the brand gradually. So initially, we were using all of the same images of me and my team that they'd seen in magazines and on billboards and so on. But with the Nelson's standard colours, which are orange, you know, with the words empowered and stronger together and things like that. And they continue to use the same kind of marketing techniques that I had. So they agreed that the billboards would continue, the magazines would continue. I continue to have a voice on the radio and so on. And so it was really important that there wasn't that, oh, Glynis Wright has been acquired, that's it, they're gagged, they're silent, they're now Nelson's, they're corporates, and they're no longer in their community. Nelson's have been really good at making sure that they use as many of the techniques that we used to. In terms of the digital media, that's been really interesting. Because, of course, being a corporate, I think their digital team tend to have to cover such a wide range of departments and regions, because, of course, they're in 3 regions. So they do tend to put out these very corporate kind of social media blogs. I mean, they're always interesting. They always look fantastic and they always look extremely professional. But I think you lose that personality. And so what we've been doing is we've been using the marketing to say, yeah, we're part of a corporate now, but we're still very much the family law team that serves you in Leicester. There's no change there. There's a change to the name. There isn't a change to the approach. So the stuff that I've been doing, pushing out there with me and my lawyers, is still very much about a local team serving their local community, providing that ethical service. And that's beginning to work really well, because I was anxious about that. Obviously, when you go into an acquisition as the business owner, you're doing it for obvious reasons, which is to cash in all that hard work and to make sure that your retirement fund is sorted out and that your team have longevity. And that's excellent. But you do care about what happens, not only to the person who acquires you, but also to your wonderful, loyal team. And I was very delighted that I haven't lost one of them, which is quite unusual in an acquisition. They're all still with me, every single one of them, and they bust their target set for them within 10 months, not 12, but 10, which was absolutely incredible. And I think a lot of that was that reassurance that, yes, we're now beginning to embrace the behaviours of Nelson's, but at the same time, we still have that unique quality, which came from Glynis Wright & Co. And making sure on an acquisition that isn't squashed out of the team that you're buying in, and making sure that actually you start embracing some of their techniques, just as I am becoming slightly more corporate in my approach, is really, really important. And the CSR, I might add, because CSR was a massive part of Glynis Wright & Co. And Nelson's have been incredibly good about saying, well, you know, tell us about the things you've done, tell us the partners you've had, tell us the charities you like to work with. Yeah, we'll do that. We'll carry that on. Because that, again, is a clear message of, we are Nelson's and we may be East Midlands based, but we care about our Leicester community and we're going to put back into our community, which was very much what Glynis Wright and Co. used to like to do. And maintaining the leadership roles that you have. Yes, we are happy for you to continue being the chair to Montford University for the faculties of business and law. Carry on doing what you're doing. So always let the person you're buying have some free rein on that. Otherwise, you're squashing out what you actually purchased. And yeah, I think businesses have been great about that.
Yeah, that makes some very good points. I'm quite conscious that we've got questions, but can I have a yes or no answer to you both on this? Does Divorce Day exist? Yes or no, Glynis?
Certainly did this year.
Katie?
No.
Hero. We've got a yes and a no. I'm sure that many of you will have your view, and please do put it in the chat if you feel like it. Hero, I'll hand over to you with the questions.
Yeah, I've got lots of questions tonight, so hopefully we'll have time to get through them all. The first question I'll come to, James and Nigel have asked more or less the same question. What's the view of our speakers on the balance between business and professional issues and personal or political issues like Brexit? What do you think, how much do you think we should go into each of those on our social media? Katie, if I can go to you first on that one.
I think it depends what you know about, if you're really interested in anything. I don't think there's a difference between politics or rowing or anything. If you really feel passionate about it, you mustn't dabble. You mustn't do, if you're going to like a comment from somebody, you've got to be prepared to listen, you know. But you know, you should be as authentic as you want to be. But so therefore, I don't mention Brexit or politics at all on Twitter, because it's not something I particularly spend my time talking to my friends about. So I'm not going to talk about it on Twitter.
Mm. Yeah, I think personality is really important, isn't it, when a client is choosing you? So yeah, actually, then if you put things out about yourself that are authentic, then they have a better idea of you. What do you think, Glynis?
With politics, I would absolutely steer clear of it, 100%. I once made what could have been a fairly lukewarm political comment, which I suppose gave an indication to my leanings. Oh my God, I had a tsunami came my way. I never made that mistake again. And it was Brexit orientated and so on. And you all know that we were all heated up at the time, weren't we? I would say absolutely steer clear of that. That's not the kind of personality issues that we're trying to get across. That's a personal opinion that is best kept to yourself. Whatever your views, you're going to offend somebody. And when I talk about making sure that your personality comes through, I'm not saying that you put out on social media, you know, I woke up today and I felt completely crap, but I'd pump myself up by 9 o'clock. I'm not talking about that kind of stuff. When I say get to know you know, get to know your achievements and get to know the things that you do out there in the community, the public digestible bits, the really personal stuff you should never put out
on social media, because it's the stuff to do with your business, but where you can talk about how you feel about that stuff to do with your business that makes people realize you're authentic. So I think you do have to have a very careful balance. You don't over gush on social media and you don't overshare. You get the balance right. It's always professional, always professional.
Yeah. Thanks, Glynis. I don't know who can remember this. I certainly can. James has asked who can remember the campaign, the All Men Are Bastards and Dump the Bitch.
Dump the Bitch,
in the early 90s. And yeah. Do you think they were brilliant or terrible? Katie, what do you think?
Well, I've spoken to somebody in that firm, and my understanding is that that is used as a case study in university. And if you think about what it did, it was a new firm coming from Australia who wanted to make their mark, and they did. So it ticked the boxes. They're very proud of that message, and they're very proud that they had a clear message that they wanted people to know about. So from their point of view, I think that was successful. And he sold out, and he's gone back to Australia, and he's got a nice pension fund. So who's the fool, really? You know, it worked for him. I'm not saying, you know, but it comes from authenticity. You know, it mimes. I love things that mime. Ditch the Bitch had a nice ring to it, but you know, it's not very resolution focused. But they're not a resolution firm, so you know, it did what it said on the tin, I think.
Well, what do you think, Glynis?
Well, from a businesswoman's point of view, you know, you have an eye to the profit. Of course, it was a successful strategy and they were ready to be sued because they'd kind of worked out that the amount of business they would bring in would probably escalate way beyond the likely damages if they were sued. I thought it was appalling. I thought it was carrying on stereotypes within our industry that I'm uncomfortable with. I thought it was misogynistic. Ditch the Bitch, you know, it's hardly a favourable phrase, is it? And I thought it was, you know, an eye to the profit over your ethical approach as a lawyer. And we shouldn't forget that as lawyers, we're meant to carry a duty of care towards our client. And we all know how horrible it is when your clients are starting off their divorce and it's antagonistic and it's highly contentious. Well, what does that do? The kind of people who are attracted to going to the lawyer who gives a message like that are going to be running highly contentious disputes and there might be children involved. So, no, I 100% didn't like it.
Okay, for the last question now, because we're coming up to 6 o'clock, maybe we can just have a show of hands or virtual hands for those who haven't got their cameras on. Manisha's asked, has work ever been generated from LinkedIn? She said she found it's great for growing her network, but not for potential clients.
Definitely wrong. You do get work from LinkedIn.
Okay, yes, quite a few hands.
A few days ago, I had somebody contact me saying, I really like the way that your post, I really like the feel. Can I come and see you or one of your lawyers? And she was a complete stranger. So there you go. You can get work from LinkedIn.
I'd say it's a challenge. Sorry,
Katie, no, you go.
I was gonna say, I think it's a challenge. If you think all your other areas are working well and LinkedIn's only the social connections, then maybe you need to tweak your LinkedIn profile to make it as successful as your other ones. There must be something that the LinkedIn profile is doing that isn't quite hitting the mark, because I know it comes. I think the marketing and people say it's all part of your brand reputation. There shouldn't be a channel that's your dart, your correlation.
Absolutely, Catherine. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning, 360-degree marketing. If LinkedIn isn't working, something else will. Look at what does work. You know, you can't rest on your laurels. You have to constantly look at the right methodology and the thing that will work for you.
There are LinkedIn tutorials, if anybody's interested, just to see how you boost your profile and things that work and don't work. I mean, I find I do get work from LinkedIn, definitely. I would say of all of the mediums, that's where I get the most, and that's where people find me. You know, and may have seen my posts or whatever, but that is where I get a lot of people inboxing, sliding into my inbox on LinkedIn. But you know, I do think that takes time. It's not good. It doesn't happen straight away, I don't think, with any of these things.
Okay, we'll have time for one last question then. Georgina has asked, what are your opinions on marketing strategy and readiness for the no-fault divorce? And are you worried about a lot of clients going down the DIY route or using the quickie divorce companies? Catherine, what do you think about that?
Well, over Christmas, I watched, I've forgotten what it's called now, A British Scandal.
Yes, that was excellent.
It was so fascinating. I absolutely loved it. And I thought it was really interesting. That was one of the best indictments of fault divorce, the problems of the fault divorce. So I don't have any problems with it. I thought that was a really useful reminder on how somebody gets completely put. There's two people at fault, two people committing adultery, two people who are unhappy in the marriage, and one person gets completely pilloried. So what was the question? I'm pleased it's coming. I'm probably going to write a blog about the Great British Scandal to remind everyone about how it used to be. I know that some people think that divorce petitions are quite cathartic, but they're not. You can never really say what a horrible person the respondent is, because they'll never sign off on it. I'm not worried about DIY wiki divorce. I don't make much money from divorce petitions. I make quite a lot of money from divorce petitions that go wrong, and the Philip Moore reported case where he dismissed 27 divorce petitions for having exactly the same particulars is a good example. There's some woman on LinkedIn who was doing a post yesterday about don't use lawyers to do a divorce. And I nearly wrote and say, you'd never say it to a hairdresser, you know, use these garden shears, do it yourself. But, you know, some people think that. And so if they want to use wiki divorce, then they won't be coming to us anyway, because we're family law experts. And if you don't want a family law expert and you'd rather use Google.
Good luck.
Yeah.
What about you, Glynis? What are you going to do about marketing that?
I was just thinking, what's the matter with garden shear? Can't you tell? In terms of no-fault divorces, it's what we all lobbied for. It's what we want, isn't it? So that we're not having to start every divorce with something unpleasant and unreasonable behaviour and contentiousness. I think it's an opportunity for us to actually say to people, look, just because you can do no-fault divorce, don't forget that the very highly complex side of your divorce is going to be the children and it's going to be the money. I mean, we're not going to lose out on business. Let's be honest, people have been doing DIY divorces for years now. I don't see them as a threat. As Catherine was saying, we don't make money out of divorces anyway. They're kind of loss leaders, aren't they? Our fixed fees. If they want us to do it, we will. We focus on our skill set, on the complexity of the situation, which is children and it's money. So I think what we need to accompany on our social media thought leadership about this is A, how brilliant it is that we as a profession, as family lawyers, have lobbied so successfully to get divorce law changed, because obviously the stereotype about divorce lawyers is that we all want this. We all want contention and we all want to shake people's pockets out, making all sorts of nasty arguments up in court. We are ethical. We brought this about. But don't forget, you're going to still need your lawyers for the divorce side, for the finance side and for the children's side. So I think there are opportunities there and we don't need to worry about DIY divorces at all.
Thank you both. That was really interesting. I'm sorry there were more questions, but we are running out of time now. So I have to sign off. But I hope you all have a lovely evening.
Yeah, thank you, Glynis and Katie, for coming on tonight. That was brilliant discussion. I think we actually have a new record of attendees tonight. Am I right, Danny?
We do, yeah. I think the previous record was about 122. We matched that at 136 this evening.
There you go.
Glad you told me that after. Yeah.
It's not the thing to open with, is it? All right, well, thank you, everybody, and have a good evening.
Thank you.
Bye.
Take care, all.
Thank you.